Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 27th, 2006. Today's session is entitled Genetic Testing and Screening. Presenter is Jan Chalupny. Number is CH-JA-2006-02. Let's listen in.
So what is that? Genetic testing, I've written a bunch of things on a board, things that we can think about as we go through some case studies. First of all, a few definitions, because you want to know what you're talking about before you discuss it, right? So genetic testing is testing individuals for expression of specific alleles. So what's an allele? That's just kind of a science name for alternate forms or varieties of a gene. Okay, so every gene that you get that are on your chromosomes, you get one copy from your mother and one copy from your father. And each of those copies is called an allele.
Allele?
Yeah, so that's just a form of a gene, really. And a gene is made of DNA. Here's my trusty DNA model. It's in the backbone is phosphate and sugar, and then these are what are called the bases here that pair together. And there are four bases that make up DNA that are abbreviated A, G, C, and T. They pair together in a specific way. A always pairs with T, and C always pairs with G. And then the resultant double strand twists into this double helical form. And so that's what all your chromosomes are made up of. It's all DNA. Not all DNA is a gene, but all genes are DNA. So some of your DNA are genes, and genes encode proteins, so they're kind of like instructions. We talked about this a little bit in my session yesterday, that you can think of the genes, the genetic material, like a big encyclopedia that's inside every one of your cells that tells the cells how to make the things that it needs to live and to keep you alive. And so genetic testing means looking at the sequence, because that can be done now through specific types of biotechnology, the sequence of the genes can be read. And so you can test whether someone has a specific misspelling for a gene that might predispose them to a certain disease. And genetic screening is basically the same as genetic testing, except that it's looking at populations of individuals. And so both of these things bring up some ethical questions. Oh, thank you. I wasn't sure whether I knew there must be a switch for those, but okay, I didn't see that switch. I tried all the other switches and figured out what they went to, but I didn't get that one. So that makes it a lot easier to see. So there are a lot of ethical issues related to genetic testing and genetic screening. And we're going to go through a few case studies just to get us thinking about how we would make these decisions ourselves, or how we would try to help someone who had to make these decisions. And there's a good book called Adam, Eve, and the Genome, The Human Genome Project and Theology, which is edited by Susan Brooks Thistlethwaite. And in this book, she suggests several questions that need to be asked about genetic testing or genetic screening. So who are the appropriate decision makers? Who decides to get the test? When is the appropriate time for testing? Which genetic test should be required, if any? Encouraged, permitted, discouraged? Whose interest should be considered in the decision? Is it solely the patient's interest that should be considered, or should you think about your extended family? Because really you share genes with your family. You get them from your mother and father, you pass them on to your offspring. So it's not just a personal thing that sort of belongs to you only. There are disclosure issues. So should the results of these tests be private? For whom should they be private? From whom should they be confidential? Is there a duty to disclose the results? If so, when? Is genetic information different from other medical information? Is it different from high blood pressure, for instance? Should it be given the same amount of privacy or more? And do we have obligations to be tested or to refrain from being tested because of the needs or interests of our family or our community? So we're probably not going to answer all those questions, and all of them might be answered differently depending on what type of genetic test we're discussing and the situation of the individual or individuals who are being tested. Those things could vary widely, but just some things to think about. And another book, if you're interested in these kind of topics, another book that's put out by the ELCA is called Genetics, Where Do We Stand as Christians? And you can download copies of this. I put the website up at the top. If you go to www.elca.org and you search on genetics, this will pop up. There's also a 1-800 number that I can give people if you'd rather do it that way. You can call the 1-800 number, and they'll send you one copy of this. If you want multiple copies, you have to purchase them from Augsburg Fortress, but you can get one sort of free copy from the ELCA if you don't want to download it. Okay, so there are three case studies that I'm not sure if we'll get through all three of these, but that I thought would be instructive to think about some of these issues. So there's prenatal testing, that's one of the scenarios, pre-symptomatic testing of an individual, and then risk testing, which is more the cancer side of it, where you may have a mutation or a misspelling of a certain gene that might predispose you to cancer, but doesn't mean 100% you're going to get it. So that's kind of a different scenario from the other two. So the first scenario involves Sarah and her husband, what's her husband's name? I can't remember. I'll get to it. So anyway, Sarah's pregnant. She's been in to see her doctor, and she has a routine blood draw where they look for a number of different things. So they're testing. And the tests come back kind of ambivalent, like maybe there might be a problem, but they're not really sure. And so they inform her, you know, things look a little funny, don't be alarmed, you know, we'd like to do amniocentesis. You know, are you willing to do that to be sure if there's anything abnormal or not? And so Sarah decides that she will. She discusses it with her husband, Alan, and they go to see a genetic counselor who helps her understand what the amniocentesis can show, which is basically it's taking some of the fluid, the amniotic fluid, from which the fetus has shed cells into that amniotic fluid, and then they can do a chromosome squash of the fetus's cells and know it, and then do genetic analysis on those chromosomes. So they can look directly at the fetus's DNA. And so they decide to get the amniocentesis, and they have that done. And the problem that they think there might be with the child is that it might have trisomy 18, which means three copies of chromosome 18. And that's a condition that causes low birth weight, mental retardation, a whole host of other problems, including congenital heart disease, and few infants survive beyond their first year when they have this. So they go ahead with the amniocentesis, and the results come back positive that their child does have trisomy 18. So that's pretty scary for them, but they have a lot of choices to make. It's very early in Sarah's pregnancy, so they there are various things they can choose to do, and so that's something that we could discuss. What are some of the things that are possible choices for Sarah and Alan as far as the continued development of their child?
Well, I suppose they think about abortions.
Right, and that's
some
something.
Wouldn't, some wouldn't.
That's something that prenatal testing brings up more than. Brings up, which other types of genetic testing don't. If you're just looking at yourself, you're already a fully developed human person, and you're trying to see if you have a gene that might cause you to develop a disease or predispose you to a disease. That's not a situation in which you think of abortion, but when you're looking at your unborn child, that's something that comes up. You could also choose to carry the child to term, and think about what kind of ways you could get ready to care for that child. And so when, if you had this type of choice to make, there are a lot of your own opinions that are going to come to bear on this situation, right? So some people might feel that abortion would be a merciful thing to do, rather than to have the child be born and have all these physical problems that may cause pain and suffering. And some people may feel that in absolutely, you know, in this case, this is just, it's not the right thing to do to abort the fetus, that it should be allowed to develop and come to term and be born and be cared for by its parents. Do people, you know, there are a wide range of opinions on this subject.
And the test doesn't say exactly how, what's the word?
Severe?
Severe the child, because there are people that have severe difficulties, but they become very productive citizens. So
that's a really good point. And in a lot of cases with some genetic abnormalities, there's a continuum, you know, a range of severity, and just having the genetic information may not give you a lot of information about whether the child would be at the more mild end of the spectrum or the more severe end of the spectrum.
Mm-hmm. I guess it's from a public health sort of kind of perspective, the cost. Because if we have children, babies that are going to be very expensive to keep alive and to treat and so forth, then do we pull all our resources from the rest of the infant population and give up on vaccinations or on other kinds of preventative kinds of programs because we don't have the money for it?
Resources is definitely can weigh into the scheme. Also the resources of the parents. What kind of health care do they have?
Well, and
what
personal
kind of
resource.
Income? Sure. Do they have a big support group? I mean, what do you think is the role of community in a situation like this, where people have this very difficult choice to make? What's the role of community?
I just think, coming from the educational, because I work with children with special needs, infants and toddlers and preschoolers, and we deal with that all the time, and there's a lot of community resources there that are out there, and it's just grouping those resources because of the funding cutbacks, federal and state, that we've had to combine resources and paper and steel from one another to work with these children. And they're all gifts. And they all have unique needs, just like any child who's within circles within the typical range. They all need help too, just in a different way.
So. In Canada, there was a case a few years ago. Latimer, I forget his first name right now, but his daughter had cerebral palsy and had a number of operations and was he claimed suffering a great deal. And he put his daughter to death through, he put her in the truck, in the cab of the truck, and, you know, put the exhaust into the truck. And in Canada, you have a minimum 10-year, he was convicted of, I think, second degree murder, and given a 10-year conviction. And it's a very controversial case. But I think part of the argument that was made is that, you know, how can you judge whether it was her suffering or whether it was your suffering that you couldn't bear, and, you know, and judging quality of life issues and a failure, and maybe in accessing those community resources that are available to you. And so I thought, I know, and you hear the disabled community say that, you know, that you know, how dare you say that this man shouldn't be given a sentence and convicted, because, you know, those quality of life issues and productivity is exactly something that we, you know, isn't an appropriate way of judging a life and a valuable life. So I guess, you know, it raises questions, I think, for me, of ethical questions in terms of, are we being consumers of our, I mean, these are all valid issues, but is there a consumer attitude creeping into even our decision of who gets to live, and in terms of our own, you know, choice is so preeminent that we should have that choice at all costs. And, you know, there's also a danger with that.
Well, I think there too are, there's so many different levels of where you make decisions, mm-hmm. and in the medical community, sometimes a lot of resources are poured into one infant, I mean huge amounts of resources, to save an infant who may be, you know, born prematurely, whatever, with serious physical disabilities, but problems that have to be attended to. And so it costs huge amounts of money to attend to those, and then that leaves no money to take care of the 99% of children, infants. And they suffer from that lack of resource. Now, I wouldn't say that you can take the life that's been born, but how much do we try to sustain that life to the
extreme measures kind of like idea?
Yeah, to the detriment of the others.
Well, and if you look at it on an even larger global scale, right, in the Western world, we can even, that we have so many resources, that's the reason that these questions would
even
come up, right? In a more developing world setting, a pregnant woman is lucky if she would get any health care whatsoever. So
it would not
this issue would never even come up. But the broader issue comes up that, you know, medicine is so costly and health care so costly here, and yet we have the resources, many of us, to access that. There are many in our communities that don't have the same resources that we might have. But in the developing world, even fewer resources exist, where people, you know, if they had clean water,
they could live.
They could live, but they would get sick much less frequently. So there's a huge ethical allocation of resources question.
Yeah. I had two handicapped children myself. They each lived 3 years. This was before the testing. But had I known, I don't think I would have ever gone through with abortion, because I feel that the good Lord knows what he's doing. And I think they deserve their life.
Yeah, that's a very valid point. What's the worth of a human life?
Yeah, and
money, when
money
do you decide when life begins?
Money's just a way of keeping track. Not with a child's life do you mess with it, the way I look at it.
To bring up another issue, could you foresee any dangers to the family having this genetic knowledge, having had their fetus tested and knowing that their fetus has this disorder? What are the dangers that you could foresee?
I've seen them, so I mean, I've seen from the point where the parents don't have another child to the parents going, well, maybe it'll skip this child and this child won't get this gene, but this child got it anyway, and the child survives for 10 months and they've gone through all this pain and, you know, and they're still in pain, but they have their own belief system and whatnot that, I mean, you know, who.
What about issues of privacy, as far as now that information's out there, that this child has this genetic problem? Could you foresee situations in which healthcare coverage might be denied by an insurance provider?
Well, I think it gets back to, Matt, that, of course, as I am the older generation, I would never think of this. And that's why, for me, as a great-grandmother, to think that one of my great-grandchild would be not able to be born because they decide on an abortion or something like that. You know, I would be shocked. And the reason is that we're making a decision, like, say, God blessed us with this baby, even though we realize it comes from a male and a female, mm-hmm. in order to have this baby. But I think we're playing God when it comes to making that decision. And I realize that I know a lot of families who have had children with many, many different kinds of infections. Or anyway, diseases and small hands or a leg that's shorter and such. But I know it's easy for me to say these words because I've had three beautiful children and I have eight grandchildren and I have a great grandson coming, or have, and a great granddaughter coming. And so I feel, sure, I'm blessed. But I think that for those who have had children, I just can't imagine saying, well, you're not going to be born because you have this little problem. Where a lot of us grow up and we have a genetic situation. Some of us get heart attacks or heart troubles. Some of us get lung troubles.
Well, and a lot of things that you might, that troubles, medical problems that you might have are not genetically based necessarily, so they would never be picked up in a screen, right?
Okay.
Or say a birth defect, like you said, missing a hand or a shorter leg. That's not something that would be screened for. So there are a lot of things that you never know until the child is born, or the child's born and then things develop as you age. You know, some things are caused by exposure to pollutants or exposure to a virus or bacteria. So there are certain medical problems that are caused by a misspelling in a certain gene, but there are certainly a lot of other problems that you may encounter or someone you love may encounter during the course of their lives that are not caused by a genetic problem or caused by a genetic problem that happens later in life.
Are we able to detect pain?
Pain?
I'm saying if someone is so severely impaired that there's no communication, they're not able to communicate, can we detect accurately if they are in fact in pain?
That's a really good question.
I have a child that has high pain threshold, feels no pain, broken arm, and don't know that it could, parents didn't know he had a broken arm until he couldn't do anything with it that had no pain. But that child in other respects is just fine. So,
in a situation where the person can't communicate,
right.
That would be
right.
Very difficult. And that could be somebody who's comatose as well from something.
Or somebody running around.
Have there been any statistics kept since DNA came into use, that how many people take advantage of aborting rather than because of the test?
There very well may be. I don't know what those statistics are.
Maybe too early.
And certainly you would think it would be an exceedingly difficult decision for the people, the two parents involved, to decide something like that.
You know, like the testing for spinal bifida when you're pregnant and then for Down syndrome when you're older.
Right. I mean, those are two tests that are commonly
do that.
Available.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know what the statistics are on what percent of people would choose to terminate a pregnancy versus the percentage that would choose to carry it to term.
I think it's important to distinguish between the different disorders you can test for between disorders that will impede quality of life versus disorders that where the child might never leave the hospital, or more than likely it's known that they'll never leave the hospital, or they'll never get out of the incubator, the parents will never be able to hold the baby before it dies. And it's important to distinguish between those two when you're looking at whether it might be better for the child. It's just important to distinguish between those two, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, and it certainly brings up the point that all these kind of things would really need to be decided on a case-by-case basis. That to have a hard and fast rule, this will never be done, or this will always be done, or this is always going to be the outcome of this result. Situations are so different. Genetic problems are very different. There can be a continuum of mild to severe. Some things are so severe, as you say, that the child only survives a few days and might be on a ventilator. Versus people that can live productive lives with their disability. So it's
sometimes they have, even though they have problems, they can affect other people in such a strong way to help them.
Right. And
that I feel that they're here for a purpose.
Quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
How do you judge quality of life or the worth of one life versus another? Really difficult,
mm-hmm.
difficult issues.
They set an example for other people at times. Very much so.
Mm-hmm, that's true. Somebody who
mm-hmm.
is dealing with a challenge every day can definitely be an example to others of us who complain about our commute because, the bridge was up and we were 10 minutes late to work, that kind of thing. Can put things in perspective and can really be an inspiration to people. Okay, well, of course, we're not going to come to absolute consensus on these issues, but I think they're good to think about, and I think it's really important to think about the different points of view. We all have our own beliefs and things that we would take into account if it was us making the decision, but I think it's important to try and place yourself in the shoes of the people that actually might be trying to make these difficult decisions. And think about what's the role of Christian community in situations like that. If this person's our friend or they're a member of our congregation or a member of another congregation, the larger faith community in general, maybe they belong to a Buddhist temple or a Jewish synagogue. What kind of responsibilities do we have towards them if we know that they're in this difficult situation? What's the appropriate way to try and support them?
Well, in our age, if there was a problem with a lot of children, they were just sent to a home.
Mm-hmm. And that's something that's very much changed.
And didn't get any help, anything. We have a situation in our town where there's one gal was put in just when she was 4 years old. No, she was only one or two. And put in a home because the doctor said that she'd never be right. And her brother finally found her after the father and mother died, and he found what home she was in after the state home closed, and she's just doing very, very well. She's learning how to talk, learning how to walk. She'd been in a wheelchair before, and she's just really,
I think some courageous parents also who have said, when they've been advised, this child is just never going to learn to talk or feed itself, or, you're just better off putting this child in a home where they can take good care of it and it won't be a burden, because a financial and emotional burden. And some courageous parents have said, I can't do that. I'm going to raise this child at home and we're going to try and, create the best learning environment possible. And that has really shown that a lot of children that were believed previously to have not much of a future as far as development and cognition and all that kind of things really had far more potential than anybody gave them credit for, if given a good supportive, loving home and maybe a wider support system for those parents and educational resources and things like that. So that's definitely something that has changed, and that there's another resource question as you brought up, that how do we have a lot of resources in our Western society, but how do we decide who gets how much? Should we spend a gazillion dollars building a sports stadium? No, which isn't a bad thing. Sports are fun, they're good for you, they're exercise, they're entertainment. But do we spend a lot of money on that and then say, oops, our school budget is really short and we can't provide support for special education, children with special education needs?
Actually, we're required to with the federal funding, as we're supposed to provide for the special needs, so then the multitude of children get
get less and less and less. And,
right, so how do we...
Like
right.
Dumbing down of society in order to encourage the uplift of them, to give them the equal balance the rest of
right.
them.
Right, and how do
so
we...
So that's a big...
try to influence those decisions for what we think is right, you know, like at the moment in our U.S. society, we're spending lots and lots of money overseas in a war effort, right? And so that's sucking tons and tons of resources out of our country that I think you could argue could be better spent in other ways, providing social services and support services for a whole variety of other things.
I think that when we talk about the war in Iraq, because it's not in the headlines and we know about it, but also the United States spends a lot of money to other countries just to keep them on our side. And you know, when we get into politics, you know.
Right, there's a whole...
You're gonna pay anybody, you're gonna pay your neighbor next door to help take down that crummy fence that he's got across your, you know, or your sharing. So it's not just wars, but it's also situations that's happened with our exchange of our own with China. And not that I'm against them, but you know, everything you buy is made in China. So I mean, so you have that. It's just it's like this situation trying to make decisions.
Right. There are certainly decisions at a very personal level,
right.
Person to person, and then
yeah.
You can think larger and larger when you get into public policy and resources and things like that.
We spend a lot of money bringing children from other countries for care here because they're disabled
right.
there.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's good.
Our money goes for taking care of them, which is good too.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe we'll move on to another scenario of pre-symptomatic testing. And so the disease I chose for us to discuss this time is Huntington's disease. So that's a genetic disease, and it's caused by this three base pair repeat that when it's in a certain place in a certain number, it predisposes a person to Huntington's disease. And Huntington's disease, the onset is very late. Well, and it depends on how many of these repeats you have. The more you have, the sooner the symptoms manifest themselves. So if you have a lot of repeats, you know, like over 67, you get it at a younger age, in your 40s. If you have fewer, maybe in your 50s or your 60s before you get it. So it's something that you can be tested for pre-symptomatically before you even have the disease. And so my kind of case scenario here is that your mother and all of her brothers die from Huntington's disease, and it's a degenerative disease where you lose control of your muscles and in your body, and so it's, I would imagine, a very unpleasant way to ultimately die. It takes years, and it's very difficult for the person who has it, and they need quite a bit of care, and so it can be very stressful and difficult, of course, for their families or caregivers. So your mother and all of her brothers have died from Huntington's disease. Should you be tested? Would you, you know, what are people's personal feelings about that? There, and there's, you know, another thing
yeah.
I need to add is there's no cure.
Yeah.
So what would be a reason to get tested?
If I was a young woman who hasn't had children, I would want to be tested because I don't think I would want to pass that
right.
particular gene down the line.
So that's why
that
it might impact your decisions around childbearing.
Yeah, there was we had friends, a family, and the mother's brother died the mother's husband died of Huntington's chorea, and then one of her children got it at like, he was 14, I think, which is extremely young. There were two girls, other girls in the family, and they were given the choice of being tested or not, and they both were getting married. One of them chose to get tested and then decided not to have children. But the other one said, no, I'm not going to be tested, and I am going to have children. And I'm just going to trust God to take care of this. So
does anyone think in a scenario like that, that anyone should be forced to be tested? Or once the results of the tests are known, whether there should be any pressure put on them to forego bearing children?
Should be their own decision.
It has to be
their own
decision.
Decision.
Yeah, like I had a niece who followed both her mother and her grandmother and her great-grandmother had manic depressive schizophrenic. It runs in the, it's passed down by the girls, so she immediately said no children before she got married. So, you know, it's your own decision on it.
But you don't suffocate from that. But, you have to look at it and then you have to make a decision. I do think it's an, I think it's a very personal decision, but I think you really have to weigh what you do to the children that you have then. Mm-hmm. You left this ticking bomb in their position. So.
What do people think about, If you are tested and you find out you don't have too many of those of the repeats and you're going to be fine, well, that's great. But if you do discover that you are going to, that there's an extremely high probability that you're going to contract Huntington's disease, do you think it's better to know ahead of time and somehow try and prepare yourself? Or better to not know? Or is the stress of not knowing going to be just as bad as knowing? You know, like living your life under kind of a cloud, thinking, am I going to get this? Am I going to get this? Oh, I felt I feel a little wobbly today. Is that, am I just tired because I worked really hard in aerobics yesterday? Or is this the onset of Huntington's?
But with the research going on the way it is and all the new things that they're coming up with, that there's always hope for that they might have something that will prevent it or help the disease.
That's
like I just heard a couple of weeks ago where they implant a chip in the body and of a person that's paralyzed, and if they think strong enough about, I want to move that leg, they can get their leg to move. I mean, that's a major advancement if this is going to work.
Well, there are definitely new advancements all the time.
Mm-hmm. So there is always hope.
Yeah. And hope is a good point. Mm-hmm. Hope in the future of medicine and hope in hope in God, hope in community.
Will the Human Genome Project ultimately, is that one of the benefits of that? When it's completed, will that somehow help to eradicate these?
So the Human Genome Project is a project that went on for over a decade to sequence all the DNA in the nucleus of a human cell to get the entire sequence of all the DNA, which includes all the genes, but also other DNA that's not genes. So to get the base sequence of all of that, and then to look for all the different genes. A lot of genes had already been identified through other means, but having the whole sequence is believed to make it easier to identify all the genes that are required to build and maintain a human person. And there's still debate on exactly how many genes there are in the human genome. So we watched a video yesterday where one of the scientists who was responsible for demonstrating that DNA is the hereditary material, said, you know, this is like a new language that we're learning, the language of DNA. It's four letters instead of our regular English 26-letter alphabet. But we're still trying to find out what the words are and make them into paragraphs and get all the information. So the human genome has been completely sequenced, or at least a representative of it, because each of our genomes is slightly different than the person sitting next to us, which is why we're all part of the reason that we're all unique individuals that look different from each other. But there's still a lot of work being done to try and determine what all the genes are. And then the genes themselves don't do things. They're like I use the encyclopedia analogy, they're like an encyclopedia of information, or you can think about them as a cookbook. And they tell the cell how to make proteins, and the proteins are the things that do things. So even once you've got all the genes, you don't know what protein do they encode, what does that protein do, how does it function in relation to other proteins. We talked yesterday a little bit about how the cell is like a little universe. There's so much going on in there. Proteins are communicating with each other. Proteins are expressed on the surface of the cell that communicate with proteins outside the cell, which may be expressed on another cell, so the two cells can communicate. There's a lot of communication going on there. And how does that affect exactly how genes are transcribed and translated into proteins? So there is still an incredible amount of information that we don't know. And the hope is that all this information will lead to better understanding of when things go wrong, why do they go wrong? That's the first thing you figure out, and that can take a really long time. And then once you know why they go wrong, how do you intervene? Is there a way to intervene and fix? So that's sort of the future hope of medicine and biomedical research. But in the meantime, and even if we knew all that, even if we could fix everything, there would still be ethical issues. If someone is born with a physical challenge, is it the ethical thing to do to go in and fix always? I mean, clearly in something, with something like Huntington's disease, which is fatal, and there is no way to slow it down or cure it, it's a more clear-cut issue. Would you want to go in and change that? It seems, you know, much more reasonable to say, yeah, of course you would. But if a child is going to be born deaf for some reason or blind, do you absolutely want to go in, want to change that? And in the deaf community, there's a lot of debate over the cochlear implants that can allow deaf children to hear. And that the deaf community is its own community in many ways, and they have a culture and a language, and so there's a lot of debate whether parents want their children to receive these implants and be able to hear sound, or whether they think it's better for them to remain deaf. Another situation where
a little different question. When a surrogate mother gets the sperm of another, of a different man other than her husband, and the egg of a different woman, is there any way that those genes jump into that baby that's being formed because it's her blood that's circulating through that?
No, the baby receives its genetic information from its biological mother and biological father. So if it's conceived from the sperm, a sperm donor and an egg donor, it has genetic information from the sperm donor and the egg donor, not from the mother in whose body it grew to term. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting, because the baby shares the surrogate mother's blood.
Right. But it does not receive her genetic information. Her body nourishes it, mm-hmm. and gives it everything that it needs to come to term, but does not provide any genetic information. And that's an issue with children. That's a different privacy issue, right? So is the privacy of the donor more important than the right of the child to know its genetic background? And maybe it's predisposed to something that it could be treated for early, or lifestyle changes. It might want to, you know, if it's predisposed, say, to some type of cancer, you don't want to smoke.
Some places, right?
Smoking predisposes you to all sorts of cancers, and if you already have a predisposition, then smoking is something you might really want to stay away from.
Sometimes the surrogate or the mother is going to already receive the information from the donors.
My niece
didn't have any eggs, but so was her husband's sperm and the surrogate's egg. But they gave her the whole rundown of what they've heard.
Well, that's interesting to know. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So I don't know if that's done all the time or not. I haven't been familiar with very many, but with her, I know that
it's also an issue in adoption as well. If you adopt a child and you do not know who the biological parents of that child are, what's the right of the child to know over the right of the biological parents to have privacy and to not be identified? And that can come into play. Say that child needs an organ transplant, and your best chance for a genetic match is with someone that you're genetically related to. So,
yeah, well, this is why they went ahead and did that, made sure that that would be available for them. So,
I always think of what does God think when He, made man and woman? Did He ever come to think that we're going to be in this big? Cloud of
Okay, so for the last scenario, it's a risk testing scenario involving one of the genes which, if it has a certain misspelling, can predispose one to breast cancer. So BRCA1. So your grandmother died of breast cancer. This is assuming that you're a female person, although males can get breast cancer as well. It's just not as common. Your grandmother died of breast cancer. Your mother was diagnosed with breast cancer, as were your two aunts, your mother's sisters. They had radical surgery and chemotherapy and are currently alive. They all carry BRCA1 mutations. So.
Sounds like my niece.
When you brought that up yesterday, I thought, that's like one of the case studies that
her mother and her aunt, they're twins, and both of them had cancer, breast cancer. And Addie found out just last December that she had it. And then I was talking to her on the phone a month or so ago, and she said they found that cancer gene in her body, and she. You know, they just never thought about that. After her mom and her sister had it, they didn't think about even trying to find out. But she's going to have a breast removed.
Right, and that's something that she decides.
She decided
right, based
to
on the information
yeah, right away.
That she gets
now
from
she has
her
two children and
care provider,
so
oncologist, etc. Mm-hmm. So there are misspellings. And one thing I'd like to just talk about a little bit is that we're very gene-centric in Western society, right? And I am a molecular biologist, so I work on genes. So, I'm right in the middle of gene-centricness because that's my livelihood. But and the way it gets portrayed when it's reported is that this gene causes this disease. But the gene itself is not actually causing it. There's a misspelling there, and then that causes the protein that's transcribed and translated that gene gives instructions for how the cell builds that protein. The protein is then has a change in it. And not all changes are bad. Some of them are neutral. It doesn't cause any problem at all. Some of them can convey a survival advantage. But some of them cause a problem. So the protein is now different, and it doesn't function properly. It doesn't function in the same way that it functioned before, and that can lead to disease, and in this
case,
cancer.
They can't, if they determine this ahead of time, can they do something about it, or are they?
Not currently, no. That's something that I'll discuss a little bit in tomorrow's session, gene therapy, which is a procedure that's quite experimental and has not been tried very many times, but where you try to put the correct spelling, the gene with the correct spelling, into the cells that have the gene with the incorrect spelling, and try to overexpress that gene so that the protein that functions properly is made in those cells. And Yeah, it is. It's very complicated. How do you get it into the cells? Viral vectors are usually what's used. A virus that's been modified so that it won't make somebody sick. But viruses are really good at getting into cells. So they make really good delivery systems if you want to get DNA, because the viruses can't survive and replicate themselves on their own. That's why there's a debate about, are they living or are they not living? They can survive. They're like a little genome. They're like a little blob of DNA or RNA that just sits there, and they can sit there for a long time. And if it gets into your cell, it can only replicate itself because it needs the cellular machinery.
Okay, what's the definition of a virus?
I mean, if they don't know what it is, it's a virus.
Well, it's a particle. They usually have a protein code.
Is it in your system?
It can be, but usually it comes from outside and gets into your system. And some viruses we coexist with, like the cold virus, right, exactly. And so some viruses we can clear easily. Some we can coexist with for long periods of time. They don't really make us sick unless perhaps we're immune suppressed. But so viruses are what have been used as a delivery system for gene therapy. But it's very experimental, and it's not. It's also expensive. I mean, my last session this week is going to be about allocation of resources, personalized medicine versus public health. So that's a huge,
Getting complicated.
It costs a lot of money to develop those kind of therapies. And then a lot of money is charged to people or their insurance companies to get those kind of therapies. Is that the best allocation of resources either in this country or if you look at it globally, where some people don't have enough food to eat or clean water.
Well, if some people can afford it, fine. And then other people can't afford something like that.
Okay. Right. We've gotten off track a little bit, but that's what gene therapy is, and that's something that's currently a very active area of research.
There's a quick question. So you say you have the breast cancer gene. But that's one piece of a whole human being. I know it's a huge piece if you have a family history. There's so many other factors to a human being. And do you then go through every potential risk that person carries and try to head it off in the past?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question. Where do you? How many things do you get screened for?
And what are the other, like you mentioned, lifestyle changes? How much proactive movement is happening by that person for other risks in their life? Toxic exposure, environmental exposure, emotional, spiritual. I mean, you think about the whole human being, and that's just, I mean, breast cancer diagnosis would be devastating, but that would be one part of a whole human spectrum from life to death.
Well, lifestyle changes are a huge thing. I mean, if you think about diabetes, there are more and more cases, the percentage of cases, and especially juvenile diabetes, is growing. And I think there are some pretty clear links to lifestyle. More sedentary lifestyle, more processed foods. Should money be poured into that versus curing someone after they've developed something that perhaps could have been avoided by healthy lifestyle? Diet, proper diet, a lot of
simple things.
Right. Cancer as well can be, there have been a lot of links to diet, exercise, things like smoking. Smoking's really bad for you. Don't do it. And that's, we have freedom of choice, personal choice, especially in the U.S. We're very big on your right to ride a motorcycle without a helmet or
freedom.
Bear arms or, and freedom is not a bad thing, certainly. But the right to smoke if you want to, but smoking is really bad.
It's
and
a choice.
It predisposes you to many cancers, not just lung cancer and throat cancer. Because what you're sucking into your body is one of those chemicals that can mutate DNA. So
bad to sit in the sun.
Also true. Ultraviolet radiation is a mutagen. And so it's really important to wear sunblock because you predispose yourself to skin cancer. And you can see a link if you look at places with more sun, places like Australia too, where there's an ozone hole right above them. So they get way more UV radiation than the rest of us, and they have a much higher incidence of skin cancer.
Excuse me. Is bacteria more complete an organism than a virus?
Bacteria can replicate itself, doesn't have to be in somebody else's cell. So in that respect, yes. Self-sustaining. It is clearly alive.
Self-sustaining.
Yes, yes.
Organism.
Yeah, virus has to enter some other host cell, subvert that cell's machinery to be able to replicate itself.
Do bacteria invade our body too?
Sure, yeah, they do, yeah. They like it in there also, so it's a food source, you know, it's warm and dark. And so it's hospitable for them as well, but they can replicate themselves without entering a host cell.
Jan, are you going to talk about designer babies in another session, or is that related to genetics?
Tomorrow, yeah. Tomorrow we'll be talking about changing an individual's genetics or selecting certain genetics over another, and we'll be talking about a case, a kind of a designer baby case, yeah. Pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, where you do the in vitro fertilization and then you screen all those embryos for certain characteristics and only implant the ones that have the characteristics that are desired. And there's a book in the bookstore called My Sister's Keeper. That's the book I'll mainly be drawing from tomorrow. Okay. So we've kind of gotten through those three case studies. Are there any other questions that people have or things that you want to discuss related to all these questions? One question that I'd like to discuss is, if you are tested for something like Huntington's and you discover that you indeed are a carrier for the gene, do you have a duty to disclose to your children if you've already had children, or to your siblings? Is that something that you should do, or maybe they don't want to know? I'm still sort of fascinated by the question of whether it's more upsetting to not know and live under that cloud, or whether it would be better to know.
I think upsetting or not, it's a part of life, and it's part of a community, as in your family, or a larger community. If people contain the quote-unquote bad things, then every time something bad happens, it continues to be an isolating event where people can't learn from each other and learn how to deal with things and how to deal with life, because these things are going to happen over and over and over. And if we never talk about it and if we don't have that interaction with the people closest to us, we never learn that these are parts of life, and they're bad parts, but they are parts, and it's a part of a bigger picture. It's a part of a lifespan, and you know, people get diseases all the time, but when you don't have any interaction with those people, with those diseases, you don't understand how to go through it, and you can never have that learning process from each other. So my argument would be that if you know something like that, or even less severely, it should be discussed, and it should be a part of sharing and relationship and a bigger community learning process.
I think that's a really good point. And in the Sarah and Alan situation, where if they decide to go ahead and have their baby, certainly it would be great for them to meet some other parents who've had children with the same condition, and learn what they did to cope, how it went, what kind of range of severity there is, all those kind of things, that can really be something that would lift people up in a difficult situation instead of being isolated and not knowing and frightened.
Well, years ago it used to be mandatory if you were going to get married in certain states or counties to be tested for venereal diseases, and now that's kind of gone by the wayside.
It's another one of those privacy issues.
And another consideration for people sometimes, even though they want to share the information, or even keeping them from finding out, the instance I'm thinking of has to do with multiple sclerosis. And a friend's daughter was told there was a possibility that she had MS. She delayed for a very long time getting getting tested at all, because as soon as she was identified as having MS, she would lose all possibility of any kind of coverage, insurance, or the possibility of getting that. And insurance is a big thing for mm-hmm. people who are
going through
this. Well,
that's when you need it the
stuff.
Most, right?
Exactly.
And then you face...
And then also other kinds of conditions can cause people to, I mean, they're real prejudicial kinds of things that happen. And so people are afraid to let anybody know what's going on because you're treated differently all of a sudden. And so it's, you know, I mean, in the best of all possible worlds, we could share with everybody and get support, but I don't think that's always the case.
Right. Something to work towards, certainly, but those are legitimate fears that people have.
Well, the person has to recognize, too, their own fear and fear of being marginalized.
Mm-hmm.
So yep. The first step would probably be to get over their own denial or whatever stages of grief they'd have to go through, which would be normal. Finally come to terms with what perhaps was in their body at a time bomb, whatever it was, and then the fear of that marginalization is a real one, I think. And resources are scarce, but maybe we're going to talk about that in another session. I mean, what will it be like in 100 years if you have a genetic problem? Would you be voted off the island, so to speak? You know?
Yeah, well, right, there's the resource question, and then there's the, if we have all this ability to be able to diagnose things early, do we select for certain things or against certain things?
And who does that?
And who does that? Well, yeah, those are all those questions. Who are the appropriate decision makers? Should these things be promoted, or should they be discouraged or even outlawed? You know,
haven't we seen some of that already with... the placenta and how you embryos, not the embryo.
Right, but yeah, no, so that's something that I'll talk about more tomorrow.
Okay.
Well, Hitler and
yes.
genocide.
Right,
and
it's eugenics, essentially.
Yeah.
It's a different,
eugenics.
More modern form of eugenics, selecting certain traits that you deem to be desirable and trying to get rid of traits that are deemed undesirable.
Stem cell. I mean, the government is already in stem cells.
Right, stem cells, that's Thursday. Yeah,
okay.
Cloning and stem cells is Thursday. Right, that's another
debate. It's
happening
now.
Mm-hmm.
This is today.
And stem cells can be used for a lot of different things, and they can treat a lot of different conditions. So it's another one of those instances where the knowledge and the ability can be used for very good purposes, but can also be used for questionable purposes. And how do you decide, you know, where to draw the line? It's just a big gray area.